Thank you, Simon. I'm Sean, I'm an addict. Hello, everyone. And thank you, Ish, for your chair, and thank you, Simon, for asking me to speak tonight. Yeah, lots of time. I've got lots of time. That's what I must remember. And sitting here now, I just started to feel, while the readings, last readings were going on, that I feel quite sort of safe, actually, in this room. And I don't feel threatened. And I don't know if that's a reflection of me or the group or a bit of both, maybe. But it's nice because it's in stark contrast to how I used to feel when I first came to meetings, you know, which was 17 years ago now. And then all I did feel, basically, in any given situation was extreme fear and anxiety. And something that had kind of been with me my entire kind of life. And it's nice to be able to sit here now and tell you all honestly that those feelings have greatly kind of diminished over the years. And I'm no longer kind of plagued by those two kind of demons, which is what they were in my life. Chronic fear and anxiety. And obviously, along with that, you know, insecurity and everything. It's easy for me to remember the first time I got intoxicated, shall we say. It was my sister's 21st birthday, which made me about 13, coming on 14. And I got drunk on champagne. And, you know, on paper, this should have been, you know, quite good, a little kind of birthday soiree, getting drunk on champagne. But unfortunately, it wasn't. You know, it was me and my older sister in our flat, and my dad had nipped over from the pub a couple of bottles of kind of warm champagne for my sister, of which she didn't want any, and I started drinking. And it's important for me to sit here now and talk about that particular thing, because what had happened a couple of months prior to my sister's 21st birthday was that our mum had died of cancer. She'd been diagnosed about 18 months previous to that. And I can talk about that now because as a man of 44 and a husband and a father of three, you know, as time goes on, I can really feel and appreciate the kind of magnitude of that. And and what it personally, you know, meant to me. Because at the time, my way of dealing with that was complete and utter denial. And just kind of, you know, just trying to pretend it didn't happen. But the effect on my family was one of total devastation. And shortly after that, my sister had left. My other sister already gone, and my old man disappeared into his kind of alcoholism, as did my older brother. And I was left to kind of, you know, basically sort myself out. When I look at my children now, my oldest daughter's 11, and I kind of, and my two sons, and I see how kind of dependent they are on me and their mum. And and the kind of how important we are to them, you know, on all sorts of levels. And so I can start to appreciate, because, you know, my whole kind of recovery for me has been about one of forgiveness, you know, and it's an ongoing thing, forgiving myself primarily for not being perfect, you know, for not being nothing short of some sort of superhero, all things, all men, the whole bit, you know. And it's funny, I got a recovery text at home that I was given in when I was in this clinic. And in the middle of a kind of very painful detox, I wrote in there that things really go wrong for me when I start to pretend to be somebody I'm not. And I mean, this was my own kind of wisdom, you know. And I kind of realised I was trying to be something I wasn't all along. And I mean, it is the classic thing. I mean, what I was, I didn't know. I had no idea. But, you know, I was telling some friends recently, you know, about 14 years of age, 15, you know, around the flats, there were some kind of leftover hippies, you know, from the 60s or whatever, still smoking dope. You know, someone used to live in this tower block in Abbey Road. I remember going up there as a kid, you know, 14. It's a friend's older brother or something. And they were sitting around smoking dope. And I mean, I'm a lot of things, you know, but one thing I'm not is stupid, you know. And as a kid, I had all that kind of, you know, being a child of alcoholics, that kind of, I could tell, you know, my old man coming up the stairs in the flats, if he was drunk or not by his cough and all that sort of stuff, you know. I mean, the kind of, the antennas were constantly out there, kind of. And I could tell at the time, these people smoking dope and what have you, and listening to Floyd and all this stuff, I mean, I don't think I was ever impressed by them or in kind of, you know, seduced by it. But on some level, I do remember thinking that this was where I was going to be, you know, and that's where I was, you know. By the time I started an apprenticeship in the rag trade when I was 16 in the West End, I was smoking dope, you know, quite regularly drinking. And the whole thing back then was, as I say, was trying to keep a lid on that terrible pain I was in. And trying to kind of pretend that I wasn't in pain. And in my own sort of way, trying to kind of project some kind of image to people, you know. I mean, I no longer condemn myself for that at all, you know. I mean, I was kind of, I can see now in retrospect how kind of lost I was. But, I mean, as time goes on, I just feel more and more compassion for myself, basically. And sitting here now thinking how short a time it was before, you know, things progressed. I mean, back then it seemed like a whole lifetime between 16, 19 and 20. But looking at that time now, it's very short, you know. I mean, the progression of my addiction, my drug use was such a classic one, you know. But by age 19, I had, you know, in my own way, succeeded in as much as you know, I had a job, a girlfriend, lots of friends and what have you. And you know, in some ways I was kind of doing my own thing. I mean, I used to look at my dad and my brother in their alcoholism, you know, and I used to come home from work and they'd both be kind of smashed, you know, in the living room. And I didn't judge them for getting smashed, but I used to just think that, you know, it's about control, you know. You know, you got to do this in a controlled way. You know, there's a time and place to do this sort of thing. And obviously I had no concept of the illness of addiction. You know, for a while there I was kind of holding it together, you know. I had a bit of a kind of, well, I didn't have a bit, I had a full blast, you know, double life going on, you know, because I was, you know, 19 was the first time it, you know, I don't know what date it was, 19, but it was you know, late 70s, and I got, you know, heroin came around, of which I got introduced to. And I mean, I've got to be honest, sitting here now, it was, you know, I rarely talk about gear, but it really kind of, you know, it did something to me, for me, to me, you know, it really did. And I haven't talked about this for a long time, really. And you know, it turned me on in a way that I just, you know, I couldn't believe. And I mean, I felt an inner peace that I just can't describe. And but I carried that kind of thought plan, a game plan, kind of view that I could control my heroin use, you know. And you know, and I, as I say, had a job, you know, it was going well, and I had a gorgeous girlfriend, and you know, and it was all kind of, you know, we used to go out a lot, and it was all happening, and it was all a bit groovy, and you know, and you know, in the early days, I'd do some gear at night, up in the morning on the way to work, have a cigarette, and I was a bit stoned again, and it was all, you know. And then, it started to change, you know. It started to change. I was no longer that interested in my music, which had been a big love of my life. You know, my sex life had started to take a kind of dive. You know, there I was with the beautiful girlfriend that I wasn't really kind of, you know. My ability to take pleasure from other things started to kind of die, basically, you know. And I think that was a very painful time for me, where there came a time, I mean, I used to call it, you know, because some friends, you know, we used to confront me about the fact that I was doing gear, taking gear. Because, you know, I grew up, you know, around the flat, so you've got all the kind of, you know, there's loads of us, and it's all, you know, some go to work, some are kind of villains, whatever they were, then starting out as villains, and I was what everyone would call a straight go, you just go to work, and then it was okay to do coke or dope, it wasn't okay to do this, and there was all these strange kind of, you know, things what you could and couldn't do, and I would be periodically confronted. And I, you know, my defence was, look, it's cool, you know, it's a flirtation, you know, it's purely a flirtation. And whether or not I believe this, I don't know, but, you know, the flirtation turned into a full blast relationship. And as I say, one of the poignant parts of my kind of addiction was the time where I kind of made a conscious decision to kind of surrender myself to the drugs, really, you know. And I accepted it on some level, and resign myself to it is what it is. And I liken that to, you know, you can walk past, you know, my older brother was a compulsive gambler, and you could walk past, still do, walk past betting offices, which they've tried to jazz up a bit. And you can see guys in there, you know, periodically I go in there and have a bet on, you know, football or whatever. And you see these guys in there, you know, sitting around, and they're kind of resigned to the fact that they're compulsive gamblers. And I tell you, man, I feel so sorry for those guys in there, because, you know, it's just, I feel nothing but compassion for them. And I really feel gratitude when I walk out of there after just putting my kind of silly bet on, you know. And it's similar to when I go jogging in my local park, you know, I kind of, you got the little kind of firmer park bench boozers, you know. And you know, I go jogging past, you know, all my gear and that. Sometimes I'm, you know, oblivious to them, other times I'm kind of a bit sort of, you know, disgusted by them. Sometimes I'm a bit jealous of them, you know, because they are playing my my favourite game, which is, you know, let's make the world go away, you know. But never do I run past and think to myself, what are those blokes up to, you know? I know exactly what they're up to. You know, other people may look at them and think, you know, what are they up to? But I know exactly where they're coming from and exactly what they're up to. And I know that resigned look in their eyes, you know. So this happened to me, this kind of surrender happened to me in the devastatingly young age of kind of, you know, 21 or something. And, you know, it's a slow kind of thing. As I had this double life, and I used to work, so I always had money. And honestly, if I tell you I am a tenacious man, you know, that is an understatement, because I used to work so hard, holding down a job and holding down a habit, and the girlfriend and this and that, and it was so painful, you know, so tiring is what it was, that eventually when this girl who I loved, you know, who I really loved, said to me, Sean, it's either me or the drugs, it was a relief, you know, when she left me. It was a relief, because it was all too much trying to run all these things, have all these balls in the air, you know, it really was. And I can remember going out that night, going out to score for a couple of pals. You know, it's, you've got a guy for a bit of use. A guy now, who I'm pleased to say is in these rooms, said to me, he still had his girlfriend, you see, at the time. He was doing that kind of, you know, the shuffle. And he said, aren't you upset? I said, well, of course I am, to a certain extent. But, you know, life must go on, you know. And what I meant was, you know, my using must go on. And it did go on. And on and on and on and on and on, you know. And on 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 and on. And every day was the same, you know. And you know, it was real low key, my using, you know. I used to joke and say to people, old friends, I'm a respectable heroin addict, you know. It's simple as that. And I try my utmost to be that, you know. And I would walk around saying to people, as I was saying in my chairs, I'd bump into people. I'd say, don't tell anyone you've seen me, you know. And no one was looking for me. That was the thing, you know. I had become irrelevant, basically. Except apart from my few loved ones, you know. Or a few people I owed 20 quid to and stuff like that, who were threatening me with, you know, violence and stuff, the usual. But I will always remember one thing I will share with you. I was out one night kind of wandering about, you know, Sunday night. It's always an awful night. Sundays have changed now, I know, but... And I bumped into an old friend, and he was even with a girl, a Spanish girl. And, you know, I hadn't seen him for a long time, and, you know, he kind of knew me from when, you know, I was a bit kind of, you know, whatever, a bit sort of, you know, cool or whatever, happening. And he said, look, come on, let's come up to my flat. Yeah, sure, I said. So I went up there, sat down, and his wife's sitting there, or his girlfriend, and he's gone out. And I've immediately said to her, have you got any sleeping tablets? And she said, you know, she didn't really understand English that well. So I've had no choice but to break into my fluent Spanish and said, you know, tablets, man, sleep. And Dave's come back in, and she's told him what's going down. And it was that kind of look, you know. And I said, look, I'm sorry, Dave, I've got a split. And I felt so embarrassed. You know, it was one of those things that stuck in my mind. And And I still think about it now, you know. I mean, you know, that's what had happened. I mean, I was kind of obsessed about getting to sleep all the time. That's all I used to seem to worry about, was will I get to sleep? You know, that's what my whole life had come down to. Will I, won't I sleep? And it was all... it was a nightmare, really. So, that gives you an example of how kind of dull it was. And then I was introduced to NA, Narcotics Anonymous, by a friend of mine. I was living in Chalk Farm at the time, and I went to this meeting in Swiss Cottage on Monday night, which is no longer there. And I had my Burberry Mac on, which was a legacy of when I used to spend all my money on clothes. And I had the Baco 4 in one pocket and the can in the other, which is what I always used to have. And at work, I had one of my sample machinists kind of, because eventually the wet cans would wear through the kind of the original cotton lining, and I had this kind of heavy sort of woolen cotton put in there so that it wouldn't fall out. And I was sitting in the meeting, and I must be honest, I felt very depressed by the whole thing, to be honest. And I think I had glimpses of that time when I was first, you know, introduced to smoking dope. The old hippies. Not that these lot were old hippies, I'm not sure what they were, but people like us, I suppose. And I didn't really, you know, if I'm honest, I didn't really get it at all. I kind of, you know, I split, and as we say, I stayed out there. And then a chain of events happened, and I ended up in a clinic in Chelsea. And the last day of my using was a Saturday. And that day, when I think back, was spent running around. I mean, I must have put so much gear and booze into me. And I still couldn't get stoned. You know, it was one of those days. And I remember standing outside the pub, you know, because the clinic was opposite the pub that night, and my brother-in-law sort of, you know, making sure I went into the place. And I had the plastic bag, you know, with some hastily packed clothing. And I was trying to force down this last half pint of lager. And there was a couple of girls here, and they said something to me, and I just kind of, you know, I felt so exiled from having a conversation with some girls in a pub or something. I mean, I really felt like I was from another planet, you know. And obviously I didn't look too clever either, you know. And I went into this place. I got reintroduced to NA. And my life changed. They took me over to this meeting one day, and I listened to a guy do a chair. It was his 3-year chair. He's still in the fellowship, I might add. And he talked about various things, and one thing he talked about was a lot of his using was motivated on that kind of, you know, a lot of them, I don't care. You know, and I used to do a lot of that. And he stopped and started to think, well, who exactly? Who am I? You know, who is this about? You know. No one really cares apart from my loved ones, you know. And that really sunk into me, and I kind of held on to that. And I started to, you know, it planted a seed, I think, and I started to think that maybe there's a different way for me, you know. Maybe there's a different way of life. But, you know, I've got to be honest, in that clinic, I used to go out at lunchtime and drink and stuff like that, you know. And avoid these breathalyzer things I had in there and stuff. And So, you know, my original game plan, it was still a bit like the old days, you know, when I used to look at my dad and my brother and think, you know, I can, you know, you've got to sort this out. You just got to, you know. And my whole thing was, you know, I was going to give up the gear and everything else and just drink, you know. Because, you know, you can't seriously not drink, you know. I mean, you can't. It's ridiculous. And so I used to go to meetings, you know. And meetings then, you know, the same as they are now, I suppose. But you know, I used to go all the time, you know, and I mean all the time, you know. But originally I'd be going and I'd be drinking afterwards, you know. And then one night I was out, and I was having my couple of drinks after the meet and that, and I'll have another one, and then. I ended up in some club, you know, where I used to live, up in Swiss Cottage way, you know. And a lot of my old mates were in there. And I got really drunk. And I found myself in the toilets crying my eyes out, you know. And I can see now that it was some sort of final surrender on my part, you know. And I left the club, I went home, and I woke my sister up, because I was living at my sister's flat at the time, and I said to her, look, you know, I'm an alcoholic as well. She said, well, you know, I know you are, you know. And that was it, you know. And thank God I haven't used or drunk or whatever since that day. And as I said, this September just gone, I celebrated 17 years clean and sober. Fellowship. And you know, I went back to meetings, and like I say, I used to go to meetings, you know, all the time. In 1990, on Saturdays I used to go to 4 meetings a day, you know. And if I was you know, I kind of completely went for it, you know. And it was very painful for me. You know, it was very painful, because I talked about at the beginning of my chair, I did suffer with chronic fear and anxiety, self-obsession, all those awful things that kind of crippled me and stopped me kind of, stopped me living my life to the full. I mean, when I go to work now in the morning, you know, I in my morning prayers, I pray for God to keep my wife and kids safe, you know, that's my main one. Keep me clean and sober, and then to grace me with the kind of the strength and the courage and the wisdom to live my life to the full, you know, to live it to the full. You know, as my mate Brian says, I mean, that kind of using was like, you know, you're driving the car with the accelerator full on and the brakes on, you know, and just like going absolutely nowhere and creating a load of noise and smoke, you know. And that whole thing of keeping what we have by giving it away. You know, the other day I was, you know, because I work around the West End still, and I mean, there's not a pub in the West End. Because I'm still fascinated. I'm still somewhat intrigued by pubs and the whole, you know, toilets and all that kind of strange, because it's not the actual using. I still equate that with the place of safety. Do you know what I mean? It's a place of safety for me. Get in there and you know. And there's not a pub around the West End that I haven't sat in, right? Trying to work, strung out, waiting for someone who I know isn't going to turn up. You know, I know he's not going to turn up, and I'm sitting in there trying to force down a bottle of sweet cider or something. And I see these pubs all the time, and what's so lovely, I walked past a pub the other day and got those memories, and further up the road then there was a delivery guy, you know, come trying to load the parcels. I said, stop right there, mate. I've opened the doors for him, the two double doors, you know. He's given it, you're a gent, mate, you're a gent. You know, I said, my pleasure. And it made me feel really good, you know. it made me feel really good, something as simple as that. So yeah, you know, when I sit here and tell you I'm married with three kids, 10 minutes, okay, so I am, and I say I love my wife and children, I mean, it doesn't, you know, I mean, I know how much I love them in my heart. And what I'm so grateful for is that in contrast, stark contrast to my poor old man, who was completely compromised by his illness, his addiction, with the way that he kind of brought his family up, I, because of these rooms and the fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous, have been given a chance to do the best I can for my children, you know. You know, I've got a daughter who's 11, my son Johnny's 8 and Teddy's 4, you know. And the other day, you know, it's funny, I went upstairs, my wife's asleep, and I looked at my wife and I thought, you know, please God, I'm going to be with her for, you know, until they put me in the ground. And I felt so grateful that, you know, for that. And my son Johnny, he's a bit, you know, he's a real chip off the old block. You know, he's kind of anxious, he's nervous, he's habits, he's kind of OCD-ish. And, you know, me and his mum spoke to him recently, and we said, you know, do you know your habits, Johnny? Because his teacher's been telling us it's affecting his schoolwork and that, and he's, you know, he's slipping behind. And it gets highlighted because his sister's, you know, very bright, and she's, you know, and his sister's very different. I mean, his sister Nancy's entering for a swimming contest, right? And I know she can't really swim that well, you know. And I just mentioned to her, has the teacher seen you swim, Nancy? No, she hasn't. But I don't care, you know. Well, you know, go for it, you know. Quite impressed with her, really. But Johnny's all, you know, he gets a bit knotted up. So we spoke to him, and I said, you know, we said, would you like to see someone to maybe help with your habits? He said, I would actually, Dad, yeah. And that's exactly what he's doing, you know. And I can't begin to tell you how much I love that boy, you know. And I mean, I'm, you know, I'm there for him. You know, I'm there for him as his mum is. And it's fabulous. And, you know, and recently, I kind of, you know, he went on holiday with his mum to France, and I'd recently bought him a kind of a Game Boy Nintendo, I think it is. One of the latest ones, anyway. What happened, he came back and he was a bit, you know, he was a bit freaked out, and he said, the Nintendo's gone, Dad, you know. And another boy they were staying with, Victor, he might have nicked it, we don't know. He might not, you know. I said, and he was a bit freaked out. He said, you know, the thing is that I don't know whether I lost it or what happened. I said, well, the thing is, Johnny, you could have been a victim of crime, or you could have been someone who just mislaid it and was careless. The thing is, I'm going to buy you an even better one. And I bought him a PSP, right? Which is a later one and more expensive. And I thought, you know, my wife said, you know, it's spoiling him and we haven't got the money. But, you know, when I think of how much I spent, you know, on gear and everything, and I don't care. They say spoiling somebody is when you get them stuff without love, you know. But, anyway, I'm sorry, I got a bit emotive about the children. But my time's running out here, and I feel like I've conveyed my story, actually, as opposed to kind of, and I feel very kind of privileged and honoured sitting here, and it's been lovely to tell my story in quite a detailed way. And once again, thank you, Simon, and thank you all for listening.
Okay. Thanks, Sean.